Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're at Jennings Cafe, and just to prove it, Don Moeller, Steve Yampieri has sent over fried pickles, because I guess he knows Dr. Wen is expecting, and a beet salad for my wife, which she's going to enjoy immensely. I don't know what that dressing is there.
He's going to love
it. Smells like some sort of, I don't know, tomato vinaigrette. I don't know. And then there's a chicken quesadilla, which I'm going to be eating as Dr. Wen is explaining all about her gig in Baltimore. How does a beautiful woman from Shanghai wind up in Baltimore, Maryland? I've been to Beijing, I've been to Hong Kong, but I've never been to Shanghai. I'm going to Tokyo in a couple weeks, so I love Asia. I love Asian food. I love Asian people. I love the respect Asian people have for each other in that culture.
Sure.
That they don't kill each other over there. You know, we need to bring some of that here. But
and our older generations too.
How'd you wind up here? You were in Compton, California, where you know, there's a Nestor Street. I went into Compton there literally last year. I was in L.A. But man, you have as storied a background for a 36 now year old person. How'd you wind up in Baltimore?
It's a long story.
We got time. That's just going to eat some quesadillas.
Right,
and blend in with that when you tell that story, Dr. Wen. One of the things that we've really enjoyed about this journey is we ask folks to talk about how that journey formed who they are.
Sure.
So this little girl from Shanghai with a mom who's cleaning hotel rooms, who then goes on and becomes a teacher.
Yep, that's
becomes
right.
A teacher. A dad who is selling newspapers, who ends up as a technical advisor to a major newspaper in L.A., daughter who goes on to talk about how that happened, how you ended up in Baltimore.
It's the American dream.
How it formed
dream.
Who
that's
you
right.
are.
That's right.
So we're going to sit back and listen.
Well, I appreciate
I might
that.
Even have a quesadilla.
Well, it is actually the American dream. I appreciate your mentioning this. In fact, I was just at the Milken Institute yesterday, was having a conference that was centered on the American dream, and I was talking about my experience also, and I think in so many ways, this is the dream that my parents were hoping for when we immigrated here. So we left China just before I turned 8 and came to a little town in Utah, which is a funny story in and of itself, because
I'm not going to let you get away with that. No, stop. I'm eating. You can't just say, well, we left China
and went to Utah.
Exactly. No. What was going on in China? Because I spent 6 days in China in 2007. Obviously, the NBA, I'm a sports guy, and what's going on there? Tell me the China your parents experienced in 1985, '86, '87.
Yeah, and we left in 1990, so it was certainly a very different
Tiananmen
China.
Square era, correct.
That's right.
Okay.
And so my parents were political activists. My grandparents were also involved in various activities. And my father was in jail for some of my childhood. And we ended up leaving, in part to escape persecution, and in part also to pursue better opportunities, which came hand in
hand.
Tell
me about your father's political activism. When you say he was a community stirrer, what does that mean in China? It's hard enough in America to be a community organizer. Don and I are trying right now. In China, you get jailed for what? What was your father jailed for?
You get jailed for speaking out against the government in any way. And again, this was back then. I don't know exactly how this reflects now. But as I understand, at the time, he was outspoken about freedom of speech. He was outspoken about what was happening, what he saw happening around them. And I think that streak, that independent streak, and the willingness to speak out certainly runs in my family. But we ended up in Utah, to your question earlier. My mother was a student, so there were few ways to leave China at that time. And she came on a student visa. She got into two schools. One was in Chicago, Illinois, and one was in Logan, Utah, which is a little town in the Rocky Mountains on the border of Idaho and
now,
Utah.
Now, a Mandarin speaker first that learned English?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And so she had those two choices. And this is pre-Google, pre-Yahoo, Alta Vista, whatever days. And this is also China.
Right.
So my mother asked her advisor, where should she go? Chicago, Illinois, or a little town in Utah?
Wow.
And her advisor said, oh, Utah.
Well, do you
That's
ski?
Where you need to be. And so that's how we ended up there.
Okay.
And then we ended up leaving a few years after when my mother finished in order to go to LA. But I think like many other immigrant families, my parents worked multiple jobs. You mentioned that my mother was cleaning hotel rooms. My father was working in a restaurant, delivering newspapers. And they worked multiple jobs and went to school and raised my sister and me.
Amazing.
And it's because of their hard work, though, that got me to where I am.
Was it an expectation? I always whether we talk to Reverend Hathaway or whoever our guests have been, was it simply, Reverend Hathaway was clear, it was his parents. It was expected that he did well in school.
Or else.
In your family, was it just simply, your mom and dad worked hard, they as we said, they're the American dream. Was it their expectation, come on now, you work hard?
There is a phrase in Chinese called 吃苦.
吃苦.
吃苦, that I heard over and over again growing up. And it means to eat bitter. There's another part of it. The idea is that you should eat bitter now to taste sweet later. And I always understood that my parents were making these great sacrifices and tasting bitter all the time so that I could reap the rewards and help our family in the long run. And that was just always the expectation. I saw how much they worked, how much they sacrificed. I mean, my mother would leave at 6 a.m. and not come back until midnight, the way that she was working. And I knew that they were doing that to provide for a better life for us. And by the way, we also were very lucky because we depended on public assistance. We depended on public housing. We depended on Medicaid. I went to public school all the way throughout, including college. I went to my local commuter school, Cal State LA, in California. I mean, this is, you know, when I hear all these arguments down about these public benefits being entitlements, they were our lifeline.
They're opportunities. They're your existence.
Well, that's right.
Well, when you mention the public assistance, as you know, and by the time this airs, it will have passed or it will have failed. But clearly, County Executive Olszewski's embroiled right now in a real concerted effort to pass a home act in Baltimore County that will help those who have been disadvantaged gain access to housing by requiring landlords to count their voucher as income, not necessarily rent to them, but count it as income. You're a great example. Your mom and dad benefited by public assistance at that time to allow them to raise their children. I look back, my mom was a single mom raising two boys by herself when nobody did that back in the 50s. Clearly would have been on public assistance had it been available then. It must frustrate you then, from a health perspective and a global leader, when you see poor people demonized the way they are.
That's right. And I see the public charge rule, for example, the Trump administration published this rule that would basically deter immigrants. And we're talking about documented legal immigrants. It would deter immigrants from seeking health care and education and food stamps and WIC and other programs that we depended on. And I think about what that means. I mean, my father, a few years after we immigrated, had a hemorrhaging stomach ulcer. And he went to the hospital and got treated, and had he not gone, he might have bled to death. And I think about what would have happened if we had to make this untenable choice between sending him to the hospital and saving his life, but then maybe we wouldn't be able to stay in the country later as a result of that choice. I mean, what kind of choice is that? And not to mention that it actually increases the cost down the line, because if we don't provide preventive and primary care to immigrants, to minorities, to people with low income, then it's going to, I mean, ER doctor, they're going to come to the ER and the care is going to be a lot more expensive then. You know, I had a patient in medical school. This was before the Affordable Care Act, who told me that she was happy that she was now on dialysis. And I asked her what she meant by that. And she said before she had high blood pressure and diabetes, she had pre-existing conditions and so was priced out of the ability to pay for health insurance. And so she was cutting her blood pressure pills in halves and quarters. She stopped taking her insulin and she just kept on getting sicker and sicker. But she said, I am so lucky now that I'm on dialysis because I qualify for Medicaid. And I can get my health care now.
Wow.
So she has to get closer to death in order to get insurance.
That's right. And
that's great.
It would cost the system so many more millions of dollars. Plus, she was working before. She was the caregiver for her grandchildren, and she can no longer do that because she's tethered to a machine. I mean, what kind of system do we live in that we force people to become sick in order to get health care? And that's a driving force for what I do, why I decided to go into medicine, why I went into the ER, because I never wanted to turn patients away, and certainly why my career is in public health, because I know that it's not enough to just deliver the healthcare. If the system is broken, we also have to be fixing that system too.
My wife's had leukemia twice. In 2014, mm-hmm. she was diagnosed at Hopkins. She's had two bone marrow transplants, a couple $1 million worth of insurance later.
Wow.
So, 155 days on rounds in the fifth floor over at Hopkins and seeing other families with different insurance. When my wife was nauseous and vomiting all night, a patch that's a $200 patch that she could get, but right. the girl in the next bed couldn't get it. The girl in the next bed the next week is then throwing up and can't get it. We had extra patches. Here, take one, right? Like, but she couldn't go downstairs and get one. And we saw this every single day. But more than that, all of the doctors, all of the nurses that were in charge of saving my wife's life, all of them had the same feeling you have, which is the government's involved and I'm a doctor and I need to understand the government better to treat my patient better. That's not what we should be doing. We should be treating the patients with medicine, not with what the government can provide. And I found incredible frustration through doctors throughout Hopkins at every level at what the government does to patients and how they stand in the middle, sort of handcuffed.
That's right.
When it comes to, do I give that med? Do I give that patch? Do I give that care? Or can they not afford that care?
That's right. There is a high level of burnout among doctors for that reason, I believe, because we came into medicine, I think, for the most part, for the right reasons.
We talked about this with teachers a lot.
Patients.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Teachers
very
have
similar.
It. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Where you want to do the right thing, but you just don't have the tools to do so. Or when you start asking questions, you're told that there's no point in asking them. I mean, what if I'm telling a patient who has heart disease that they have to eat healthier foods, and they tell me that actually they live in a food desert where they have to take two buses and then walk 10 blocks just to get healthy fruits and vegetables. Am I really doing this patient a good service by saying that they need to eat healthier when I know that they can't literally do that? And that's why public health and the work that we came to do in Baltimore is so important, because I see public health as leveling the playing field of inequality. We know based on research that over 90% of what determines how well and how long you live isn't the literal healthcare that you get, although that healthcare is really important. But imagine if a child is coming to me all the time, coming to me in the ER all the time with asthma. I can treat that child with inhalers and steroids, but if he's going back to a shelter where everybody smokes, or going back to an apartment where there's mold everywhere, or there's an incinerator nearby, that's not really improving his health unless I can also change the environment that's around him too.
And that's the jumping off point. Let's jump off there, and you're eager to talk about it. We're eager to listen. What you just described sounds so overwhelming. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm going to throw my hands up. These environmental factors, which I'll call them.
Right.
Environmental factors are so overwhelming. How do we make a difference? Yet, from 2014 to 2018, you made a difference. And that's not just because you're sitting here. You were seen as one of the people in the United States of America making a difference in public health. So when you look back at your 4 years in Baltimore, what did you identify as the major issues, and what are you proud of that you accomplished?
Well, I appreciate the question and the way that you framed it, too, because it's so true that when you look at these big problems, what we in public health would call the social determinants of health, right? Because it's not just the health care, it's also the education, the poverty, the environment that you live in, the air that you breathe, the transportation that could be barriers. Sometimes it seems so overwhelming that you don't know where to start. Or the other thing that I really hate is when people simply present the data on the disparities. Yes, I know there are health disparities everywhere. I mean, in Baltimore City, there's a 20-year difference in life expectancy depending on where a child happens to be born into. Mm. And yes, those disparities also correlate with each other. The same areas with high overdose also have higher cardiovascular disease, also have high infant mortality and low life expectancy. But there is somewhere that we can start.
Does that mean, just for all of us and our listeners, does that mean if I'm born in Rowan Park versus someone born at Pennsylvania in Asquith,
sure,
that I'm likely to live 20 years longer because I'm born in Rowan Park?
That's right. Or 20 years less.
A couple of miles away.
That's right. So your life expectancy of 65 years or 85 years, which in this day and age should be considered so unacceptable and so unjust that our goal has to be not only to improve the health outcomes overall, but we have to specifically call out the disparities that are bending the arc of our universe away from justice. And that is a part of the philosophy that I used in the Baltimore City Health Department, is focusing on health disparities and on health equity. It's also taking action now and looking at not just what we cannot do, but what are the concrete things, the low-hanging fruit that we can do right now, that we can take action on right now. So I'll give you a few examples of this. One of our signature programs in the health department is Be More for Healthy Babies, which is a public-private collaboration with over 150 partners in the city that within 7 years has reduced the infant mortality in our city by almost 40%. And close the disparity between black and white infant deaths in that time by over 50%.
Now, tell us what that looks like then. How did that? What does that program look like to get those results? Did you do?
It involves home visiting. So pregnant women get triaged according to levels of need. Somebody who has both physical illness and perhaps mental health issues as well as substance issues may have a nurse come to visit them at home. Others may have a community health worker, a community health educator visit them prenatal and doing postpartum visits. They get education on the ABCs of safe sleep. They get lactation support. Women who need it also get free cribs to further assist.
I learned a lot about that at Baltimore Homecoming, that many women leave the hospital and literally their baby, they have no place for their baby to sleep except on a bed, on a couch, on the floor. That literally for $10, something that feels like something you'd have groceries in, literally, can become a bed, a sleeping bed. And I was SIDS and sudden infant death, and I was made aware of that. And
that's right. That's low-hanging fruit, a simple intervention that can save lives.
$10 box, literally.
That's right. That's right. And similarly, we started a program together with Johns Hopkins, Warby Parker, and many of our donors in the city called Vision for Baltimore, where we had a previous study that found that up to 10,000 of our school-age kids in the city needed glasses, but we're not getting them. Now, I don't need another study to tell me that if you don't have glasses and can't see, you can't read, and maybe you're even labeled as being disruptive in class and as a problem student, all because you needed glasses. And so we started this program to get screenings and eye exams and glasses for all children who need them, free of charge, right in their schools, in every grade, without the kid missing school, without the parent missing work. And again, something that was pretty cheap. But I just remember, I still meet these parents from all over the city who show me their kids and their nice new Warby Parker glasses, which I'm wearing one too, not trying to promote, but just saying they were a great partner with us. And it was really incredible to see how something that small can have a transformative effect on people's lives.
Equitable, but not equal, according to Dr. Hornbeck.
We
had Dr. Hornbeck on.
Nestor's become a fan of equitable, not equal. Exactly. Well,
not every child needed glasses.
Correct.
Just to clear off our point, but the ones that do, we need to help those kids.
Two really concrete examples. Take another issue.
Yep.
That you addressed, because here's what
Let's
we're
talk
trying.
About opioids. How
well,
about
we're
going
to do a whole segment on opioids.
Okay.
We can hang on, because we can't do opioids in a couple of minutes.
All right.
I'll tell you what we can do in a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back
sure. And
do the whole segment on
sure. Opioids.
As we record this, and this will be up in a week or so, it's been about a week since you, along with others, eloquently spoke at Congressman Cummings' funeral. Talk to our listeners about your relationship with the congressman and what you felt like that day celebrating his life.
I miss Congressman Cummings every day. I didn't know him until I started my job in Baltimore. I knew of him, of course, but I didn't know him. And I actually remember our first meeting very well, because we were all giving a speech about health disparities and calling attention to disparities in our city. And I remember when he was speaking and talking about our children who are living messengers to a future we will never see, and how this work is so much bigger than us, and taking action. And of course, he got the crowd on their feet, and they were applauding and cheering and saying amen. And then they said, and now we have the new health commissioner for Baltimore. I thought, that's why nobody wanted that speaking spot right after Congressman Cummings.
Never speak after Elijah Cummings,
No, that's a pretty good rule. I think that's what Dutch said. He said he always ended up speaking after Elijah, and it was never a good thing.
Because of his seniority.
Right, it was never a good thing.
But I got to know him very well. Actually, the day that we met, he gave me his cell phone number and said, I need you to call me because I will get you what you need to help the city. And that's what he did throughout. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I called him, how many times I asked him for advice.
Example. Give it, you called him and asked him for what that you needed, and how does the government try? I'd love to know as a citizen. Right. You know, when the leading doctor in the city needs something,
calls the congressman
and says, I need this. Tell me how America works. Because that's literally when it works right.
I don't know if this is how America works, but I knew this is how Congressman Cummings would help me. I mean,
how America should work.
Exactly, right? I mean, when we knew that certain programs were reaching the end, that we would not get funding for our child health programs, for teen pregnancy prevention, for women's health programs, I would call him and say, this is a problem. Here's how this will affect 20,000 of our residents. Here's what's going to happen to pregnant women in our city, to children in our city. And he would say, I will help you find those resources. And that happened over and over again, whether it was mental health, school health, violence prevention. He would figure out resources for us. And I also called on him a lot. I know we'll talk about this later, but around the opioid epidemic, because of his moral authority, he came to so many events to help to illustrate that addiction is a disease and that we should treat it. And he was also just such a wonderful personal mentor to me.
So much so that there's a certain little child
right.
who bears his name.
That's right.
Tell us about that, how that happened.
Well, my husband and I were trying to figure out, as new parents do, what we should call our baby. And then it dawned on us that we wanted to name him after someone that we really admired and the kind of person that we wanted him to grow up to become. Someone who was not afraid to take on the big problems, but at the end of the day had the biggest heart of anyone that we knew. And so we decided to name little Eli, who's now two. And what I shared at the service, at Congressman Cummings' service last week, was the moment that I told Congressman Cummings that we had decided to name him Eli. He cried. And he's been such a light in my life, and I know in so many others. And I will truly miss him.
You can see it, and you can hear. You said, of the many eloquent things you said that day, I was struck. You said, he always reminded us that our conscience should become our conduct.
That's right. That's right.
And I thought, wow, Dr. Nguyen just summarized and captured the life of Congressman Cummings. Our conscience should become our conduct. Good time to take a break.
Dr. Nguyen's here. We're at Jennings Cafe. We got quesadillas. We got pickles that she's not going to eat. We have a beet salad that my wife is going to eat. We're going to be at State Fair. We're going to be at Fadley's very, very soon. Check out our schedule at BaltimorePositive.com. Lots of episodes ahead, but one more with opioids and more with Baltimore with Dr. Nguyen. We're at Jennings Cafe. We are Baltimore Positive and WNST.net, AM 1570, and WNST Towson, Baltimore.